Silent Waves contains material that may be distressing for some listeners. If any of the content is triggering for you, please refer to the support organisations in our show notes. Act 5.
Can you run us through what happened?
Well, I'm not going to go through what actually happened because that's in here, but I can go through my experience. Like, I'm going through quite a tough time at the moment, so I just ask you guys for your sensitivity to that. And you know, I'm going through issues that I've sort of put in the past for a long time, so including, you know, long and complicated, very complicated history of sexual abuse, suicide, depression. So please give me space, guys, please. And you want to speculate on something? Why don't you speculate on my history of sexual abuse? You want to speculate on some real stuff? Speculate on that, you know? So please give me my space. I really respect that. No, that's it. No, that's it. Thanks.
This is a media interview with my brother Heredia from 2013. Our eldest brother Gabriel had woken from a dream and called each one of us. It was about Dad. When I heard the news, I ran. I didn't know where I was going, only that I needed to be as far away from home as possible. I was found hours later, crying in a park. Since that day, I never spoke to Gabriel about it, until now. My name is Raquel O'Brien, and this is Silent Waves.
So I can pinpoint exactly, like, the event where I became submissive, I guess you would say, to everything. Mm-hmm. I was 12 years old. It was Mum's birthday, so it would have been, like, November 96. And I was out playing on the front garden with my friends or whoever, and he came storming out and he's like, "What the fuck are you doing? Like, you should be in there helping your mum. She's doing the dishes." And he took me around the side of the house and punched me in the ribs. And like not just tapped me, like punched me in the ribs, like really hard. And like, I was, up to that point, he'd never done anything like that before. And I was like, whoa, I was pretty shocked. But from that point on, I realised that when I look back now, even though you know, I was too young to process it at the time, that's when I like let go of something where it's like I allowed him to have that something over me, you know?
Yeah,
it was like,
well,
he almost shocked it into my system.
Within abuse, there needs to be an element of fear.
Look, I can't even remember exactly how it started, but it would have been in the form of a game. At that point, I'd started, you know, having wet dreams and I was like stepping into my own, mm-hmm. pretty like, you know, sexually developing, and I think he took advantage of that, you know, and he's just like, I used to play a game when I was your age with my mates and we'd have competitions to see who could ejaculate the quickest or who could shoot the furthest or who could come the
quickest. What shoot the furthest is in?
Ejaculate
like,
the furthest. What is shoot the furthest? You know, all these kind of games that he planted in my head, like they were cool. You know, and I was like, oh, that sounds cool. I didn't say that sounds cool, but I was like, okay, is that what, that's what you guys do, all right, whatever. And so I think I can't pinpoint exactly when it happened, but...
But it would have started as a game.
It always was a game. But I do remember he started giving my penis a nickname.
Right.
And it was...
Before he went to jail.
Before he went to jail, and it was Rudolph, I remember. It was, like, really weird.
That's really,
you know,
weird.
So it's like he made it like this game. It was a game. It's Rudolph. This is what we do. At that point, it was just like sitting together and wanking, you know?
Yeah.
Not touching or anything like that. And then he went to jail and that was it.
My brother was also groomed, but in a very different way to me. The beast of grooming takes many forms. Dad returned from prison when Gabriel was 14.
I can't remember how it picked up again. I assume it would have started the same way as like a game and it just went on from there, you know, but it got more and more like he wanted to like touch it more.
When would you allow him to touch it?
I wouldn't really. I would be really like, no, you're not touching it. But then he'd want me to touch his and like finish him off sometimes. And I was like disgusted, like I didn't want to. But there was times where I would just touch it, you know, and I'd be like, oh, it's disgusting. Like I was never felt right with it, and I think he knew that. Like, he'd sometimes go, like, oh, it just doesn't seem like, you know, you're into this like I am. And
really?
I was like,
but that's
yeah,
kind
I'm
of
like,
weird.
Yeah, I'm not. I was like, and that's when I'd start going, well, you know, like, I'm growing up, like, What do I want to do this shit for, you know? And so we started, like, arguing a lot.
I remember how cruel my dad was to Gabriel around this time, malicious even. One time when he was angry at Gabriel for going out with his friends, he left a plate of dog food in the fridge for him to eat when he got home. He thought it was funny. It wasn't. It got to a point where Gabriel had had enough.
So I just said to him, like, I'm too old for this shit. I think that's my actual words. Like, I'm too old for this shit. I think that was, like, 2004. And he wanted me to get involved in this project. And, you know, I was interested, like, OK, how do you make money?
I remember this.
Whatever, rah, rah. We did a road trip to Lake Grace and we stayed the night there in this hotel or whatever they had. And I remember at a pub and we were drinking and I was drinking with him. We were getting pretty drunk. And one of the bartender girls who was, like, from England and she was, you know, doing a thing there, her and I were just, like, chatting and you could see that there was, like,
something going on.
There was an attraction and I think he could see it as well. And she wanted me to stay and drink and he wanted me to come home with him and go to bed. He's like, in the car, I tell him, get in the car. And I'm like, I don't want to fucking get in the car. I'm happy here, like, I'm having fun. Gabriel, get in the car. And I was like,
wow.
And, you know, I'm pretty drunk. And I was like, yeah, okay, maybe I should just get in the car. Like, I'm pretty fucking drunk. Got in the car and we went and stayed at this fucking hostel or hotel, whatever. And I was asleep and I think he started, like, coming into my bed with me. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? And he was like, you know, I was like a little bit drunk, but I was still really aware of what was going on. He's like, oh, Gabriel, I love you, I love you. And I was like, the fuck? And I, like, rejected him. And he turned around and he was like crying or something. It was really weird.
And I was like, oh my God. But when he said, I love you, did it feel like he was
into me?
Like confessing his love
to
you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I was just like, fuck. I was like, fucking roll over. I was just like, fuck it off. Like, go to sleep. You're drunk.
I'm still trying to process that.
Yeah, that's pretty full on.
That is.
Imagine getting told by someone who you think's your dad that he loves you and you're like, what the fuck? Like, fuck off.
The man I most loved and respected was a child molester. I knew the harm that was done to me through my abuse. And to think that my dad was capable of the same behaviour shattered my illusion of who he was.
Tomorrow morning we'll see if any of those wishes came true.
You've got to understand that also for me, when you're talking about this whole idea of, like, holding a facade, I was also doing that because for me it was like if I said no or I stopped doing it, the whole shit was going to crumble. Because I was his outlet.
Awareness of that.
Yeah, I was a massive awareness of that. I could see that it was, when I say massive awareness, like, I knew it, like, intuitively that this was my role in this. I'm keeping this shit together because if I didn't, shit's going to flip the lid.
Which it ultimately did.
So when I...
Oh, that makes me
When
cry.
I pulled away, it was like, that was it. It was like, shit just went...
Did you ever tell anyone what happened?
Never.
Up until his death. Never.
Never.
Do you think that tarnished your relationship with mum in any way?
Oh, there was moments where, you know, they were fighting and he definitely manipulated me to, like, see mum in a bad way. You don't do that to your kids. Mum's a beautiful person. Like, you don't say that about someone's mother to this. So it's not nothing that should be mentioned to the kids.
Through my research into grooming, I learnt that it's not only victims that are affected, but those close to them too. Offenders are extremely cunning. Plus, if you never suspect family, it's easy to miss the signs.
I think Mum kind of always had an inkling, but it was fucking hard, a lot to take in for her. She didn't want to believe it. And I wasn't going to fucking sit there and go, yeah, this is what's going on.
Yeah.
So it was all just like, let's cover it up.
My whole PhD thesis was around this issue of trying to understand the perspective of women whose children had been sexually abused.
This is academic Kathy Humphreys. She's the Professor of Social Work at the University of Melbourne.
There was story after story that had a lot of regularities in it. Well, either the way in which the child was abused in the context of fear, of which she was also being abused as well, or the more successful abusers who managed to, in a way, continue for long periods of time the abuse were those where they groomed in a different way. And part of that grooming of the mother was to drop little poison barbs, like, so that if the child ever disclosed, she would not be believed.
Dad did it all in reverse. Instead of putting poison barbs in Mum's head about Gabriel, he put them in our heads about Mum. We've been conditioned to think mothers should know, that abuse shouldn't happen on a mother's watch. We criticise them as if they're at fault for not protecting their children from abuse.
You don't think. You do not think. Do you understand? You don't. So that needs to be the awareness within the families that you can actually talk openly about everything mutually. How could I pinpoint Ralph as my son's offender when they're still relating well in front of me? How could I just go and say, Gabriel, I never saw anything. Actually, once I did, actually. I went to the back of the room. I didn't see anything, but Ralph was always when Gabriel... And I said, what are you doing here? Why are you always here? He said, what are you trying to insinuate, that I'm doing something with him? And I said, I don't know. And then he said, look, Gabriel, listen, Gabriel, look what she's saying. And then he had this massive thing. And then Gabriel said, Ma, are you crazy? And then I, look what I do. I'm the one who is crazy, so I retract.
Dad made Mum believe she was crazy for ever questioning his actions. He needed her to retreat so he could continue his abuse. He would attack her character to deflect negative attention from him. And as a lawyer, he was good at it. He had a way with words. The fact is, though, the perpetrator was never my mother. It was Ralph, our father. Mum was married to Dad for 20 years, only to find out after he had died that he'd been abusing her son.
I was angry. I was completely sad, very, very sad, disappointed, betrayed. After being there for him in the worst part of his life when he went to jail, and I was there, I welcomed him back with open arms. I accepted him. I, you know, forgave him. And then to find out that was really, I was stabbed like a thousand, millions of times. I was dying inside.
Yeah.
And then I said, that's it. He now he's dead. Then I didn't feel any of the attachment anymore. For me, he died now. He completely dead. So that moment.
Do you think that in terms of if he was still alive and you found out that he had done that, do you think you could ever overcome that with him? Forgive him for that?
No. I couldn't.
I could hear how psychologically damaging my father's betrayal had been for Mum.
I was actually sleeping, making love. I had children with him. How could he ever done that to me, knowing that I trust my son with him?
Back when Gabriel told me I wasn't ready to smash the image of my father, I wanted to know how my second eldest brother, Heredia, felt, considering his complex relationship with this man.
I wasn't actually too surprised. I hadn't yet come to grips with putting the label on it, pedophile or pedophilia. But I knew that there was something that was definitely off in that relationship between him and Gabrielle, and I hadn't properly processed it, and it sort of made me really feel uncomfortable. You know, I never saw anything, but there are definitely boundaries that you can tell if they have been crossed. And I feel the way in which Ralph would express anything around sexuality, I could tell that there was something off, and there was an awkwardness. It was almost like it was distorted and deformed, and it was very unnatural. I wasn't really surprised. It was like I always perhaps inherently knew without putting a name or labelling it.
I was 20 years old when Gabriel broke his silence. It was the same year I met my boyfriend, Marlon. He'd come over from Brazil to study English, and we got together the day we met. At that point, we'd only been together for 3 months.
When you first spoke about your dad to me, you and your family didn't know That's much about him. The first bit was just seeing this guy that did wrong things in the past for whatever reason he had. You know, you wouldn't show much anger. You would just like, I miss my dad. I want to be with him. That's all of the things that you used to say to me. I want to be with him. I don't want to be here. He needs me. I want to be there with him.
It was Marlon who came for me that night after the phone call with Gabriel. He'd searched for hours and eventually found me in the park.
And I don't think we even, like, spoke about it that night.
I don't think we did.
No.
I don't think I could.
No, didn't. It was just like your body there, your soul was gone.
I didn't tell anyone, out of fear I would be judged for who my dad was. It was another secret for me to bury. It added to the tapestry of my trauma. This year, I realized if I was ever going to overcome what my dad had done, I needed to understand who he was. I didn't know much about the life he had before our family. He was estranged from his sister. Collaterally, we were too. Her name was Julie, and she lived in Canberra with her daughter, Erina. I reached out. Julie agreed to talk. I planned a road trip with a good friend of mine, Alianne. Before I left, my family warned me they heard she could be cruel.
So, Raquel, what did you think about Julie?
I loved her so much more than I thought I would. She's not as intimidating as I was told she would be, and she's got a crude sense of humour, so did my dad, but she is also very loving and nurturing, and I think she's been unfairly represented by my dad, and that's for reasons that we are discovering now. So I was getting really nervous. I didn't know what to expect, and then we saw 263 and I knew it was there, and then we walk up to the porch. And we're walking up the steps and the door's already open and Julie's already there. I got in and then I hugged Julie and I hugged Erina, and it felt so nice to hug them. And then I saw my dad. It was weird. And then I just saw my dad, and it's been 8 years since I've seen anyone who looks like my dad. And I looked at Julie's hands and they were exactly like my dad's hands, and it was overwhelming. And then she started speaking, and I just couldn't believe that we were there. It was really, really, really full on.
We'd gone for dinner. I didn't know how much Julie knew, and she had no idea what I knew, so we started rolling.
Ralph was 6 years older than me.
Yes.
Actually, he wasn't. He was 5 years and something like 330 days. I can't remember.
I was hearing about my dad's childhood for the first time. All I had before were pieces of the puzzle that he'd given me.
And so that whole time, though, Ralph was living at home with the family.
He never left home.
So he never lived in an orphanage and he never grew up with Nana. No.
Orphanage?
Yeah.
It didn't surprise me that my dad had fabricated elements of his childhood.
Your granddad could have sold ice cream to Eskimos. He was the best salesman you've ever met, and that translated into lying.
And do you think that Dad, my dad, Ralph, picked that up from him, his ability to lie?
Oh, I think so. I think so. He had a pretty torrid childhood with my dad.
But your mum sort of overcompensated.
Overcompensated, yeah.
For that.
Yeah, very much so. Mum idolised Ralph. Absolutely idolised him. He could do no wrong in her eyes. Which was sad.
For you?
For me, but also it was not good for Ralph. If any child is brought up believing they cannot do wrong, they get a hyperinflated view of their own importance.
Was the same said for Grandad and Ralph's relationship?
No.
Did they have a good relationship?
No. I heard that Dad was drunk and abusive one night and Ralph got under the bed to avoid being bashed, beaten by Dad, and Dad got a broomstick and was poking and thumping him with a broomstick. So the relationship was not good, even as a little boy. Now, Ralph wouldn't have been any more than two or three at that stage.
My grandfather was a World War II veteran. Julie confirmed that his wartime trauma was a brooding presence in their household. My dad had been abused at the hands of his father and then became an abuser himself. He was perpetuating a cycle, whether he realised it or not. I really wanted to know if he abused anyone apart from Gabriel. I knew that he had a foster son from a previous marriage. His name was Glenn.
His relationship with Glenn was it was very close, actually. I thought it was a close relationship. You know, I actually thought, well, he's a good father. For him to do that for a child, foster a child that has been abused and everything. So I sort of admired that. So then when we came back from Brazil, went to live in Perth, suddenly Ralph stopped, said, oh, no, I will never talk to him again in this situation. He despised me and after everything I did for him and, you know, and that was it. I didn't want to really get involved because that was his relationship with his son. What am I supposed to do, yeah.
And did he make mention of Glenn at all after that point, after that? He was just, Glenn was out of sight, out of mind.
Like Glenn was dead.
I needed to know more. The only way to get through to Glenn was via Facebook. Hello, Glenn, I wrote. It's been years. Is there a number I can call you on? Miss you. I know. I have been hiding, he replied. But we have to talk. I love you all, but I also know you don't want to hear my truth. Reading Glenn's message made me realise that he was on a journey of processing his past. But he wasn't aware that I was too. Then, one winter's day, Glenn told me he was in a cab and on the way to my house, ready to talk. Next time on Silent Waves.
How deep do you want to go?
Yeah, go for it. Nothing shocks me.
In so many ways, Ralph and I had what you would refer to as a relationship.
And so the person will hide their secrets. They will try to be normal and they will marry and they will deal with their problem in a socially isolated way.
It's almost like it was another cycle coming. Things are working in cycles.
If you've been enjoying listening to Silent Waves, please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review to help spread the message. Silent Waves is created and produced by Raquel O'Brien and me, Georgina Savage, in partnership with Nearly Media. The show is hosted by Raquel, and I'm the editor. Music production by IAMXO of Alt Music Group, with audio assistance by Lloyd Richards and Charlie Vonnox. Our graphic design is by Stacey Gugulis. Kathy Humphreys features as the expert of this act.